This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. The only West Virginian to pilot a shuttle mission brought unique qualities to the program.
Especially having had Vietnam War combat experience, he knew what he was getting himself into and the willingness to take the risk anyway.
That story and more coming up this West Virginia Morning. Support for West Virginia Morning is proudly provided by Luke Frazier. A utility executive says new federal rules could force expensive upgrades to West Virginia's coal plants or shut them down. Curtis Tate has more.
West Virginia is among 22 states seeking to block U.S. Environmental Protection Agency rules in the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. So is Appalachian power parent American Electric Power. Last month, Gary Spitznagel, AEP's Vice President of Environmental Services, told the court that compliance with the wastewater treatment rule could cost $900 million. That would cost electricity customers in West Virginia and Virginia $42 to $60 a year, he said. If AEP does not comply with the rule, it would have to shut down the John Amos and Mountaineer power plants in 2034. If the company chooses to retire the plants, it must decide by December 31, 2025, Spitznagel said. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Curtis Tate in Charleston.
The Allegheny Front, based in Pittsburgh, is a public radio program that reports on environmental issues in the region. Here's their latest story about kayakers making art from the stuff that washes up on the riverbanks around Pittsburgh.
From a kayak, you can see a lot of stuff floating in and along the water. Recently, some Pittsburghers made art with it. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsoppel. The Allegheny River is a popular place to kayak in Pittsburgh. This July, a nonprofit combined that with art making as part of an outdoor community art series. The Allegheny Front's summer intern, Lauren Myers, went along.
Monica Cervone McElwain is a full-time K-12 art teacher, but she's also a mixed media artist. And today, she's the head sculpture maker and kayak guide.
Welcome to my little Turtle Cove tour.
Turtle Cove Inlet is just upriver from here. That's where today's tour participants are going to create art using materials from the shoreline.
The rivers are so important to Pittsburgh and we need to use them more, and I love having this opportunity to bring everybody in to share you something that I really enjoy.
15 people are gathered here in the parking lot of the marina where the kayaks are stored. The event is organized by ShiftWorks Community and Public Arts, a Pittsburgh-based nonprofit. People toss their keys into a bread basket for safekeeping. Participant Stephanie Bowes, who's wearing waterproof sandals, isn't sure what to expect today.
I've never been kayaking before, so this is actually my first time doing it, and it's something I've been wanting to try, so I'm excited and a little nervous.
But Cervone McElwain reassures them that the trip is about being creative and finding joy.
So I kind of think that there's like this inner childhood time to just breathe and relax and not worry about everything else that we are so busy with in our everyday lives, to just kind of explore.
After Cervone McElwain's pep talk, people zip up their red life jackets and load into the kayaks.
All right, let's get on the river.
Within 10 minutes, the group reaches a strip of land jutting into the river. The kayakers climb out onto a pebbly shoreline. They circle up around Cervone McElwain as she's setting out supplies like scissors and a spool of wire for constructing today's sculptures.
As you're walking around, if you want to use one of these picker-uppers, you can. There are gloves.
She tells the group to spread out and find materials to make their art.
There's a whole bunch of just random findings that we can use. All right, enjoy.
Before long, Bowes, along with Carrie Travellino, are bending over chunks of mixed glass and pottery, rocks, feathers, and a small fish skeleton they've collected.
It's making a little pile of treasure.
A few yards away, Abby Humphreys and her fiancé, Corey Derringer, are constructing a turtle sculpture balanced atop an old car tire. Muddied bricks and pieces of driftwood are the flippers. Then Derringer holds up a metal cylinder with a wide, flat base.
And I really don't know what this is. Like maybe a funnel?
The metal funnel becomes its head, and the couple step back to think of a name for their trash turtle.
We could just call him Garbage.
Because he is garbage, Humphrey says. But that's what's special about it for Derringer.
Sometimes you throw something away and it's gone from your mind, right? But it's not gone. It's just out of sight. To see stuff that like somebody threw away and like to see it repurposed just calls attention to that. You know, it never went away.
Some of the trash collected today also will be taken back to be disposed of properly. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Lauren Myers.
Well done, friends. I think hopefully you all enjoyed yourselves.
The Allegheny Front is based in Pittsburgh and reports on regional environmental news. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. It's 7:50. Areas of fog this morning, becoming partly to mostly sunny. High temperatures in the 60s and 70s. Clear overnight with lows in the 40s and 50s. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs in the 70s. Support for WVPB is provided by Marshall Health, providing comprehensive primary and specialty care throughout southern West Virginia and the tri-state region. More at marshallhealth.org. NASA astronaut John McBride died earlier this month at age 80. He was the only West Virginian to pilot a shuttle mission with Challenger in October 1984. Curtis Tate spoke with Jennifer Lavasser, curator of space history at the National Air and Space Museum, about what McBride brought to space flight and education.
McBride was supposed to fly another shuttle mission in March 1986, but the Challenger disaster put the program on hold. Did that have a deterring effect on recruiting new shuttle astronauts?
It's a really interesting, this sort of the period in between January of 86 and February of 2003 is really interesting in that, especially that early part in the late 80s when the program comes back. It is a time when something like that could have really pulled the curtain back and shown potential applicants, wow, this is really dangerous, but, you know, then there's a potential, you know, threat to my life. But I think for the most part, people ignored that, but that was an assumed part. I mean, having talked to as many astronauts as I've talked to, and read as many, you know, astronaut biographies and interviews and things like that, oral histories and so on, it does not diminish the appeal of being a part of it. So whether, you know, there's for some, as I think he is not uncommon. The problems on Challenger, and this is the story to just keep in mind about both Challenger and Columbia all the time, is nothing that happened on any of those wasn't something that they didn't already know there was a problem with.
What made McBride, as well as some of the members of his shuttle team, good teachers?
It does not surprise me that so many of the people and looking, I always like looking at an image of a crew and going, okay, so what did this person do afterwards? What did this, and you go, wow, I'm looking across the front row of their portrait here in space. And it's like, you know, Kathy went on to work at Center of Science and Industry. Sally started Sally Ride Science. So, you know, it's just a very natural fit, I think, in terms of kind of becoming a facilitator for learning about aviation and spaceflight. And that's, you know, kind of what we do here at the museum. It makes these people very identifiable for many of us as well. It's just, you know, finding ways to take what you know about these really difficult, complex things. And flight and spaceflight are both very complex things that take a lot of training and time. And, you know, I've hardly met an astronaut to date who hasn't had some pretty strong skill in communicating. Some are better than others. I think that's just natural habits. They tend to not be engineers. Those that are engineers tend to still struggle a bit. But I think the pilots, the scientists, the medical doctors and things like that, there is this level of communication that's really required in their sort of profession as a whole. And as an astronaut, certainly. And so being pretty skilled at, you know, working in, say, a business setting or in an education setting kind of comes a little naturally to those people.
How much was McBride's upbringing in West Virginia a factor in his selection by NASA?
There are more than a few of these folks who are incredibly humble and just feel, you know, and spoke often about how, you know, fortunate they felt for being selected. And I think that's almost always the case when you hear like an interview with a new astronaut or a new group of selected astronauts, is just how honored they are to be a part of it. You're becoming part of a really elite and select group of individuals. And I think in this case, because the shuttle was brand new when they were selected, it was still years away from flying. They were coming into this sort of legendary group, this office, where, you know, some of them, these are their childhood heroes, you know, being born in 43, I mean, he would have been, you know, what, a teenager when the original Mercury 7 were selected. And so these are going to be some of his inspirations and heroes. And I think there's, for somebody like him who's, you know, got those figures to look to as the exemplars. And keep in mind, especially in this early part of the shuttle program, NASA does really encourage, and I think it continues, I know it continues to this day, is to utilize their retired astronaut corps to come in and kind of prep the new astronauts.
What sets the original group of shuttle astronauts apart, including McBride, from others?
You know, I think there's still something to be said for especially John McBride, people like John McBride, people that were part of the 1978 class, for really going in, and I would say he would be one of them, having especially having had Vietnam War combat experience. I think he knew what he was getting himself into, and the willingness to take the risk anyway, the willingness to look at a vehicle like the space shuttle, which is not, we always say it's a vehicle of compromises, because there's a reason that it looks the way it does. Nobody was ever really very satisfied with the final design, but as a pilot especially, he clearly was willing to put aside many, many, many concerns and still fly on it. And I think that takes a lot. And that's something that, you know, we can certainly look to as sort of a part of the bigger story of people exploring space, is that, you know, we were built to be on Earth. So the willingness to take that risk and ride on top of a controlled explosion into space, and be the person at the controls, I think that's the sort of tribute to him and to other, you know, space shuttle pilots of especially, well, pretty much the entire space shuttle era, but especially that early period.
That was Jennifer Lavasser of the National Air and Space Museum speaking with Curtis Tate about shuttle astronaut John McBride. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University and Marshall University School of Journalism and Mass Communications. West Virginia Morning is produced with help from Bill Lynch, Brianna Heaney, Chris Schultz, Curtis Tate, Emily Rice, Eric Douglas, Jack Walker, Liz McCormick, and Maria Young. Maria Young produced today's show. I'm your host, Teresa Wills. This is West Virginia Morning.